This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Our first question comes from Great Old Mac, who asks, "The textbooks state that sunspots have a lower temperature than the surface. If so, shouldn't they sink into the interior? So what pushes them up to the surface?"
Well, as most of you all know, sunspots are dark spots on the surface of the sun. They're not actually that dark, but they're darker than the surrounding surface of the sun by a factor of about 3 to 13. The reason they glow less brightly is because they're colder. The surfaces are a balmy 3,000 to 4,500 degrees Kelvin, compared to the positively toasty 5,776 Kelvin of the rest of the solar surface. So what causes them? Well, there's two important factors at work on the solar surface. There's convection and there's magnetism. And just like a boiling pot of water, convection keeps the surface of the sun bubbling over, bringing hot material from the inside of the sun up to the solar surface. Magnetism on the sun's a bit more of a complex affair. Just like the Earth, the sun's thick atmosphere doesn't rotate as a solid body. It rotates quicker at the equator and slower at the poles. And that takes the sun's inherent magnetic field and it winds it up a bit like a dynamo. The stress of this wound-up magnetic field becomes too much, and the magnetic field lines erupt from the surface of the sun. These magnetic field lines then cause hurricane-like vortices in the solar surface. Material in these vortices stops being heated via convection, so it cools down relative to the surroundings, and a dark sunspot is formed. These sunspots can persist for weeks at a time, and they're often accompanied by prominences, which are caused by material trapped in the magnetic field that's emanating from the solar surface. But eventually the magnetic stress of these loops becomes too great, and the magnetic field snaps back into a more stable configuration. The trapped material is then suddenly freed, and it explodes out of the sun in a coronal mass ejection. Now, these are the main sources of aurorae that we see on Earth. So if you keep an eye out on websites like spaceweather.com for a spotty sun, these spots might produce a solar flare that can trigger a magnificent geomagnetic spectacle for you here on Earth.
Okay, thanks for that answer. Next question is from Beeswax Bob, who asks, "If I swim in the sea and the tide goes out, I go out with the tide. Am I being pulled by the water or by the moon?"
Well, both, really. It kind of depends on how you want to look at it. You're pulled by the moon all the time, and the Earth, and the sun, and every massive body in the universe. But if we put aside such pedantry, what exactly is it that causes Beeswax Bob's bathing perambulation? Well, put simply, his motion across the ocean is caused by the friction that sticks him to the water that's flowing out to sea. So he is just pulled out by the water. But that's not the whole story, because we have to consider what a tide is. Not all places in the world have two tides a day. Some places only have one, depending on exactly how the water sloshes around that part of the ocean. Some places even have four tides a day, but this is rare. And this is because the ocean doesn't simply rise and fall as the moon passes overhead. The tide behaves as what's known as a driven harmonic oscillator, which is better known to you and I as a spring. Now, driven harmonic oscillation is exactly the same effect that an opera singer can use to break a wine glass, and it's the same principle that caused the Tacoma Narrows Bridge to collapse. But you'll probably have experienced this effect firsthand if you've ever tried walking with a full cup of tea. A cup of tea naturally wants to slosh around with a particular period, and that's called its resonant frequency. And people typically step in a near multiple of this frequency, and that causes a resonance that makes you spill your tea all over yourself. You can stop this happening by stumbling around like a drunken fool. It's what's known as a random walk, and that avoids setting off this resonance. Incidentally, if you're going to try this at home, please use cold water instead of hot tea, and make sure that no one's watching you. But just like a cup of tea, when the tide flows, the moon's gravity is exciting this oceanic spring and setting off whatever harmonic resonance it can, whether it produces one, two, or even four tides a day. And the restoring force, which ebbs the tide, is simply the Earth's gravity. So depending on how you want to look at it, either you are dragged out to sea by the friction of the water, or you're pulled out to sea as the water relaxes into the Earth's gravity, or you could simply be bouncing up and down in the spring excited by the moon. Either way, the energy that provides the tides ultimately comes from the Earth's rotational inertia. So you're being pulled out to sea by the Earth's spin. The energy from the tides is slowly being transferred from the Earth's spin into the moon's orbit. And that's causing the Earth to spin slower. The day gets longer by about 23 microseconds every year. And it's also causing the moon to spiral away from us. It gets further by about 3.8 centimeters, about an inch and a half every year. But don't worry, the moon won't escape the Earth's orbit before the Earth's oceans are vaporized by the expanding sun. So we can keep bobbing in and out with the tide until then.
Well, that's something really interesting to think about next time you go to the beach, I guess. Really good question, and thanks for that answer, Ian. Final question is from Richard Elvin, who says, "Given the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, finding that permanently shadowed craters at the moon's poles could be as cold as 35 Kelvin, does this make a superconducting magnet catapult that could launch cargo to Earth a practical proposition?"
Well, who doesn't fancy the idea of a superconducting railgun on the moon? I certainly do. So I thought I'd do some digging and work out a few numbers. It turns out this idea might just about be technologically possible, but it probably isn't economically sound. Now, the potential problem is that your launch vehicle will be seated in a deep crater at the lunar pole. It doesn't have a line of sight to Earth. Now, you can probably get away with the orbital dynamics of this. It's going to increase the energy cost a little, but it's probably not going to be by very much. But the more serious problem is that the superconducting magnets stop being superconducting when they reach very high magnetic fields, the kind of magnetic fields we'd need to launch this kind of spacecraft. So your railgun is probably doomed from the start. But I didn't really want to let a little bit of physics like that get in the way of good argument. So I've decided we can build any kind of electromagnetic launcher and site it at the lunar equator. Okay, decision time. What's your launcher going to look like? You need something capable of firing a projectile at the 2.4 kilometers per second that you need to escape the moon's gravity and be captured by the Earth. That's not that hard. The US Navy and, rather surprisingly, the Yugoslavian Military Technology Institute have both made railguns capable of achieving these velocities. But these fired solid projectiles, not cargo-carrying missiles. Now, a larger projectile can carry more cargo for its weight. Having considered a few options, the best design that I could find was in a 2003 article by Ian McNabb, and he proposes a mile-long electromagnetic cannon which fires projectiles into low Earth orbit. Now, I adapted this design for superconducting magnets in a lunar launch, and I found that we can probably get about 12 tons off the lunar surface in one go. But the actual cargo capacity is going to be a little bit less. These projectiles have to be sufficiently magnetic to accelerate in the launcher. They have to withstand forces of about 200 times the Earth's gravity. And they also have to arrive safely at the Earth's surface. Now, packing in parachutes and that kind of thing, let's say you've got about 5 tons of cargo space left. The trouble is that this launcher design would weigh about 3,300 tons. Powerful magnets weigh quite a lot, so it costs quite a lot to launch them. It's difficult to put a precise figure on how much it costs to get something to the lunar surface, but a commercial company called Astrobotic is mooting about $1.2 million per kilogram to transport any cargo to the lunar surface. At those prices, it's going to cost something like £2.6 trillion just to transport the parts of your accelerator to the moon. That's about 5% of the world's total gross domestic product, never mind the cost of putting it together. There's also the question of power. For one launch per day, we'd need about 400 kilowatts to recharge the magnets. Operating a nuclear power station on the moon sounds a little bit too much of a technical nightmare for me, so I went for a simpler device called a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. I scaled up the specs from an old Russian surveillance satellite, and found that a 400 kilowatt unit probably weighs something like 300 tons. Or you could just replace it with 2,400 square meters of solar panels. That only weighs about 38 tons, and that can be launched for a bargain price of £30 billion, even if they only work during the day. Now, if you add the cost of putting it together, you're probably talking somewhere in the region of £4 trillion. That's the combined budget of the world's major space agencies for about 130 years. Of course, if they were really trying, like the US did with Apollo in the 60s, they could probably afford it in about 20 years. So it's not beyond the wit of man, but it's technologically difficult. But is it economic? Now, we might consider mining the moon for helium-3, or rare earth elements. Helium-3 currently retails at about £10 million per kilogram. However, the practicalities of transporting a sufficient weight of gas inside a small projectile make the economics of railgun-launched helium-3 impractical. On the other hand, gold, platinum and rhodium each cost about £25,000 per kilogram, which mean you could probably make something in the region of £125 million per payload. Now, these probably exist in fairly localized concentrations on the moon, but you'd probably still have to bash away at several cubic kilometers of rock to get enough for a single payload. Even assuming you've got some kind of self-replicating robots to strip the entire lunar surface for you, you'd probably have to return about 100,000 payloads before you broke even, and that would take centuries. You'd also saturate the world's markets, tripling the amount of metal in circulation in each, and driving the price way down. So even though it's probably on the verge of technological achievement, it would be pretty difficult to make your money back because of the sheer expense of getting your launch vehicle to the moon. You might be able to get around this by harvesting some of the building materials from the moon itself, but even then it would probably be too expensive. Thankfully, there's another solution. We've been working on a commercial estimate of $1.2 million per kilogram to launch material to the moon. That money mostly goes in getting stuff off Earth. But in today's money, the Apollo program only cost $1.5 million per kilogram, for which we can send a man and a hammer and bring him back home to Earth. He'd still struggle to make enough money to make it financially viable, but given that moon rock goes for about £4,000 a gram, he could probably at least pay for his return fare.
Thanks for that, Ian. If you want to send in your own questions, you can do so on our website at www.jodcast.net.